Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on iatrogenic disease when we come back. You know, with an income of $50,000, you're paying $7,650 in Social Security taxes. Well then, shouldn't you subtract that $7,650 from your $50,000 income? And then pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance. Instead of paying 17% of that $50,000 a second time. But you know the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of $50,000 in Social Security tax. That's right off the top. And then they make you pay an additional 17% of the same $50,000 in income tax after the $7,650 has already been taken away in Social Security tax. That means that you're paying 17% of that $7,650 two times. Now that's a bookkeeping trick, and that little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300 from everyone that pays that tax. What would you think if Sears or Penny's or your credit card company did that? They charged you twice, like Social Security and the IRS does. I thought you'd think that's just kind of real special. Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school and be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, tax and status is available in compact disc for adult home education. That's our school. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click onto that email on that website, the email. Click onto it and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, iatrogenic disease. We're talking about doctor-induced or medical or caregiver-induced disease. Now, the low-end number, the low-ball number, is 98,000 a year that are killed. So far, the high-end number that we've seen is 783,936. As I said last time, you can't really depend upon the numbers. At least not any single number, but if we can put two or three witnesses together, they'll start to give us a composite view of the overall problem or the overall story. Now, the underreporting of iatrogenic events is a real problem. Underreporting. See, first of all, we're getting reports that have various numbers. But are we getting all of the reports in? And the answer to that is no. As few as 5%, and no more than 20% of these iatrogenic acts or events are ever reported. This implies that if medical errors were completely and accurately reported, we would have an annual iatrogenic death toll much higher than the 786,000 or 783,000 in 1994. Now, in 1994, Leapy, said his figure of 180,000 medical mistakes resulting in death annually was equivalent to 3 jumbo jet crashes every 2 days. Our considerably higher figure is equivalent to 6 jumbo jets falling out of the sky every single day. Now, what we must deduce from this report is that medicine is in need of complete and total reform. from the curriculum in medical schools to protecting patients from excessive medical intervention. It's obvious that we cannot change anything if we're not honest about what needs to be changed. And this report simply shows the degree to which change is required. Now, we're fully aware of what stands in the way of change, that is, the powerful pharmaceutical and medical technology companies, along with other powerful groups with enormous vested interests in the business of medicine. These institutions, these corporations fund medical research. They support medical schools and they support hospitals. They advertise. They advertise in the medical journals. These are what we call deep pockets corporations. They entice scientists and academics to support their efforts. And such funding can sway the balance of opinion from professional caution to uncritical acceptance of new therapies and drugs. You have only to look at the people who make up the hospital, medical, and government health advisory boards to see the many conflicts of interest. The public is mostly unaware of these interlocking business interests. For example, a 2003 study found that nearly half of the medical school faculty who serve on institutional review boards to advise on clinical trial research also serve as consultants to the pharmaceutical industry. The study authors were concerned that such representation could cause potential conflicts of interest. A news release by Dr. Eric Campbell, the lead author, said, quote, "Our previous research with faculty has shown us that ties to industry can affect scientific behavior, leading to such things as trade secrecy and delays in publishing research. It's possible that similar relationships with companies could affect the IRB members' activities and attitudes." Now, remember last time I said that you can't depend upon the paid lobbyists and the corporations or the reports that you get from prestigious sounding groups like the National Institute of Insurance. Let me tell you why. The John Deere Company, John Deere, they make farm machinery. Well, the John Deere Company, let's suppose they have an engineer and he comes up with a new device called a field chopper. And this device goes out into the field and it chops corn or chops grass and clover. And it does a marvelous job. I mean, it's just like a big lawnmower and it can take down 3 foot high, tall, vegetation, chop it up into little pieces and make cow feed out of it. Now, the John Deere Company wants to sell this machine because they're in the machinery business and it makes sense. Now, to them it makes sense, but you know, cows have been going out into the field and just eating from day one. And it doesn't cost anything. You just put the cow out in the field and she eats the grass and you drive her home and you milk her and you take the milk and send her back down in the field and she eats the grass and you bring her up to the barn and you milk her and that goes on. Now, to convince farmers that they should lock all of their cows up on a feedlot and feed those cows chopped grass, that takes some salesmanship, especially when that farmer has to invest many thousands of dollars in the plant. So the John Deere Company went to the Davis Research Facility at the University of California and gave them a $3 million grant back in the 1950s. And when the Davis University, that is the professors and the college people, got through field testing these choppers, they put out a report. Do you think the report was critical of the field choppers or the field chopping idea? No. They painted it in glowing terms. Why, this is the most profitable thing that you farmers can engage in. Everybody needs a field chopper. And you put your cows into a feedlot, and then you feed them that feed right there. It was the beginning of industrial agriculture. Well, I remember old John Enos, when I was a kid, about 15, this is back in the 50s when this field chopping idea came around. Francis Capini, he jumped right onto it, locked his cows up, and started chopping the feed. And this went on for two or three years, from about 1956 or 7 until about 1962 or 3. And old John Enos, he told me one time, he said, you know, I don't want to spend the money, and I'm just too damn lazy to go down there and spend 5 hours a day working, chopping feed. Now, I was a young kid, you know, under 20. I just loved riding the tractor and chopping up feed and running machinery, and it was exciting to me. Young kids, they just love it. Old men, they look at it and say, is there any profit in it? And Francis Capini said, well, of course there's profit in it. I've got this study from the University of California. Now, out of the feedlot every year, we had to haul all of that manure down to the fields that we had been chopping. Furthermore, it cost a lot of money because we had to hire guys to help us haul the manure out. See, the cows, when they're out in the field, they're naturally fertilizing the field with their droppings. By 1962, field chopping, it was proven by the actual people who were working the fields that it cost more money than it produced. So it just died on the vine because the farmers couldn't make any money at it. In other words, they were out here working an extra 5 hours a day and then losing $100 a day on top of it. They weren't breaking even, they were losing money. Now, that's the example that so poignantly impressed upon me that these big multinational corporations could buy the kind of scientific results that they wanted. And the universities will publish the papers and give them the science that they want to sell their products. Now, if it'll work for John Deere tractors and farm machinery, will it work for pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies? And the answer is absolutely. Absolutely. Now, medical ethics and the conflict of interest in scientific medicine is now blown wide open. Jonathan Quick, he's the director of Essential Drugs and Medicines Policy for the World Health Organization, known as WHO, WHO, wrote in a recent WHO bulletin, if clinical trials become a commercial venture in which self-interest overrules public interest and desire overrules science, then the social contract, which allows research on human subjects in return for medical advances, is broken. Unquote. As former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Marcia Angell, struggled to bring greater attention to the problem of commercializing scientific research. In her outgoing editorial entitled, Is Academic Medicine for Sale?, Angell said that growing conflicts of interest are tainting science and called for stronger restrictions on pharmaceutical and pharmacological stock ownership and other financial incentives for research. When the boundaries between industry and academic medicine become as blurred as they are now, the business goals of industry influence the mission of medical schools in multiple ways. She did not discount the benefits of research, but said a Faustian bargain now existed between medical schools and the pharmaceutical industry. Angell left the New England Journal in June of 2000. In June 2002, the New England Journal of Medicine announced that it would accept journalists who accept money from drug companies because it was too difficult to find journalists who have no ties. Another former editor of the journal, Dr. Jerome Cassier, said that was not the case and that plenty of researchers are available who do not work for drug companies. But according to an ABC News report, pharmaceutical companies spend $2 billion a year on more than 314,000 events that are attended by doctors. The ABC News report also noted that a survey of clinical trials revealed that when a drug company funds a study, there's a 90% chance that the drug will be perceived as effective, whereas a non-drug company-funded study will show favorable results only 50% of the time. So it appears that money can't buy you love, but it can buy you any scientific result that you desire. Cynthia Crossan, a staffer for the Wall Street Journal in 1996, published Tainted Truth, The Manipulation of Fact in America. It's a book about the widespread practice of lying with statistics. Commenting on the state of scientific research, she wrote, "The road to hell was paved with the flood of corporate research dollars that eagerly filled gaps left by slashed government research funding." And her data on financial involvement showed that in 1981, the drug industry gave $292 million to colleges and universities for research. By 1981, just 10 years later, the figure had risen to $2.1 billion, more than three times as much, or about three times as much. Now, those multinational pharmaceutical corporations aren't tripling their advertising budget or their grant budgets because there's no return involved or because they're just altruistic. They do it because it's business. It's nothing personal. It's just business. And their business is selling drugs. And they want to sell more of them to a wider audience, a wider variety of people. And they want somebody else to say, no, you don't need this drug. It's not going to be me. I'm the guy that benefits from the sale of it. So they go to the colleges and the universities and they say, hey, listen, why don't you test this? See what you think about it. And by the way, here's a grant. Here's a grant of $100, $200, $300, $400 million. Now you tell me that any university president that receives $100 million as a grant or a research fund is going to turn out a bad research paper for the donor and say, no, your product, Vioxx, is a killer. It's no good. It kills people. Now, remember when Vioxx hit the market, they had all glowing reports. This was the greatest painkiller. It was the greatest thing since sliced white bread. And it was on the market for about 5 years, killed a bunch of people. I put a report on here one time about a drug. It wasn't Vioxx, some other drug. Killed 50,000 people. 50,000 people killed by this one drug over a period of about 10 years. It's only 5,000 people a year, and out of a population of 250 million, you know, what's 5,000 people a year? It's not even on the radar screen. But, you know, for the 5,000 families of those victims every year, it's pretty important. Now, when one person dies in your family, that's a family tragedy. That's something that's pretty important to you. But it's not something that's going to make national headlines because it's one isolated death. But if we could tie that one isolated death with another one and another one and another one, pretty soon we have 5 or 10. And then 10 can be multiplied into 100, and that's what these researchers are doing here. We're starting to take a look at iatrogenic death, or medical death, death by medicine, and we're starting to find out that, hey, wait a minute, we're killing more people than we're saving. That's right. I mean, if you're talking about a total death rate in this country of 2.7 million, I believe, was the last number I saw that die every year. 750,000, 750,000 die from cancer. Half a million die from cancer. 750,000 die from heart attack. I mean, that's a million and a quarter right there. That's about half of the total from those two diseases. All other causes combined. Now take the third number. If it's as high as 750,000 to 1 million people a year, that's all the rest of the people that die. Now, I'll be the first to suggest that these numbers are probably too high, but 250,000 to 500,000 sure isn't. And that's because of the underreporting. Now, I reported to you some time back when we were looking at vaccinations. Vaccinations have adverse reactions. The pharmaceutical industry went to Dick Armey. Dick Armey was a legislator in the Congress. And he slipped a bill into an overall bill, some bigger bill, that exempted the pharmaceutical companies from lawsuit in the event of an adverse reaction to a vaccination. Well, now, the only reason you'd want to do that is if the product that you're selling is no good. If the products that you're selling are good, then there's no reason for you to have that kind of blanket protection. You're not harming anybody. But if you are harming people with your product, you need legislation like that. So it sends me a signal. It says, well, the pharmaceutical industry needed the legislation because the vaccines are a hazard. Now, the hazard from the vaccines fits a small number of people. I mean, you're vaccinating millions, but there are only a few thousand that come up dead or end up with some kind of an adverse reaction or a total disability. And they say, well, that's the price you pay for good medicine. But wouldn't it be a little better if we didn't have to pay any money for vaccines? We could live for 70 years and never get sick. Did you know in the Bible that there's exactly that promise? It's in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, coupled with an odd statute in Exodus 15, verse 26. No sickness, no disease, and 25,550 days of life, 70 years, guaranteed. 80 if you're strong. Some people can live to be 80. Now, we're all going to die, but dying from a heart attack or some kind of a drug-induced medical phenomenon called iatrogenic disease at age 37, 45, or 52 isn't the stuff of long, healthy, vigorous life. Now, it gets better as we progress. Dr. Lucian L. Leapy, L-E-A-P-E, opened medicine's Pandora's box in his 1994 paper, Error in Medicine, which appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association. He found that Schimmel reported in 1964 that 20% of hospital patients suffered iatrogenic injury with a 20% fatality rate. In 1981, Steele reported that 36% of hospitalized patients experienced iatrogenesis with a 25% fatality rate. And the adverse drug reactions were involved in 50% of the injuries. In 1991, Bedell reported that 64% of acute heart attacks in one hospital were preventable and were mostly due to adverse drug reactions. Leapy focused on the Harvard Medical Practice Study, published in 1991, which found a 4% iatrogenic injury rate for patients with a 14% fatality rate in 1984 in New York State. From the 98,609 patients injured and the 14% fatality rate, he estimated that in the entire U.S. population, 180,000 people die every year as a result of iatrogenic injury. White Lippi chose to use the much lower figure of 4% injury for his analysis remains in question, using instead the average of the rates found in the three studies that he cites, 36%, 20%, and 4%, would have produced a 20% medical error rate. The number of iatrogenic deaths using an average rate of injury and his 14% fatality rate would be 1,189,576. So let's take that number, 1,189,576, if you extrapolate it out from the material that he used. Now, he doesn't explain why he came up with the lower number. So I can't explain it. He didn't explain it, and I don't know his answer. But if you use those numbers, 36%, 4%, and 20%, averaged them out and extrapolated it over the whole population, it wouldn't be 180,000, it'd be 1,800,000. Well, it would be 1,189,000, be a little over 1 million people. Now, Lippe acknowledged that the literature on medical errors is sparse and represents only the tip of the iceberg, noting that when errors are specifically sought out, reported rates are distressingly high. And he cited several autopsy studies with rates as high as 35 to 40% of missed diagnosis causing death. All right, let me pause right there and comment on that. You go to the doctor, and you say, I've got this or that symptom. And the doctor says, oh, my God, you've got cancer. Now, the reality of it is, you're having a stroke. Now, the doctor starts treating you with cut, burn, and poison for cancer, doesn't treat you for stroke, and a little later on, you die of stroke. All right? That's called a missed diagnosis. Had you gone to two or three doctors with the same symptoms, it would have cost you three times as much, and you didn't want to spend that kind of money, right? So you went to one doctor, the doctor said, oh, you've got cancer, when in reality you're having strokes, you've got atherosclerosis, and you're suffering from stroke, but it hasn't struck you yet. And so while he's giving you the medicine for cancer, this medicine for cancer might actually kill you. In any event, it isn't going to help you because you don't have cancer. Now, how do you like those facts? Lippe calculated the error rate in the intensive care unit study. First, he found that each patient had an average of 178 activities. That is staff, procedure, medical interactions a day, of which 1.7 were errors, which means a 1% failure rate. This may not seem like very much, but Lippe cited industry standards showing that if in aviation a 1% failure rate would mean two unsafe plane landings every day at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport. In the U.S. Postal Service, a 1% failure rate would mean 16,000 pieces of mail lost every hour. In the banking industry, a 1% failure rate would mean 32,000 bank checks deducted from the wrong bank accounts. Now, boys and girls, that doesn't happen in banking, it doesn't happen in aviation, and it doesn't happen in the mail. But it does happen in medicine. And extrapolate it out. If the post office screwed up, you're going to lose a letter, but you're not going to lose your life. If the bank screws up, you'll lose some money, but you're not going to lose your life. But if the hospital screws up, you have a distinct possibility of losing your life. Now, Lippe also noted that an intensive care unit reported an average of 1.7 errors per day per patient, and 29% of those errors were potentially serious or fatal. So Lippe says that these errors occur at the rate of 1.7 errors per day per patient. That is, every single patient in the hospital has nearly two mistakes made on him every day he's in there. Now, granted, most of the mistakes are harmless error. It's a term we use in law. Harmless error. It doesn't affect the outcome one way or the other. But you know, you just keep mounting those up, 1.7 a day, and you're in the hospital for 10 days. All of a sudden, you got 17 errors that have been done, and one of those errors could kill you. In trying to determine why there are so many medical errors, Lippe acknowledged the lack of reporting of medical errors. Medical errors occur in thousands of different locations, and they are perceived as isolated and unusual events. But the most important reason that the problem of medical errors is unrecognized and growing, according to Lippe, is that doctors and nurses are unequipped to deal with human error because of the culture of medical training and practice. Doctors are taught that mistakes are unacceptable. Medical mistakes are therefore viewed as a failure of character, and any error equals negligence. No one is taught what to do when medical errors do occur, And Leppy cites McIntyre and Popper, who said the infallibility model of medicine leads to intellectual dishonesty with a need to cover up mistakes rather than to admit them. And there are no grand rounds on medical errors, no sharing of failures among doctors, and no one to support them emotionally when their error harms one of their patients. Now, Leppy hoped that his paper would encourage medical practitioners to fundamentally change the way that they think about errors and why they occur. It's been almost a decade since the groundbreaking work, but the mistakes continue to soar. Let's take a minute here and let me give you a reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. And the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, and a final reminder that the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. However, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that these authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate and recommend the Law Hour and Editorial Review. And most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, the beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing Death by Medicine. A report put out by www.lef.org. I don't know what LEF is, but if you'll go to the webpage www.lef.org, it's a 29-page report, and you'll see by Gary Null, Ph.D., Carolyn Dean, M.D., N.D., Martin Feldman, M.D., Deborah Rascio, M.D., and Dorothy Smith, Ph.D. Well, back in 1995, the Journal of the American Medical Association report noted that over 1 million patients are injured every year in U.S. hospitals. They also reported that 280,000 die annually as a result of these injuries. Therefore, the iatrogenic death rate dwarfs the annual automobile accident mortality rate of 45,000, and it accounts for more deaths than all of the accidents combined. All right, now, got your pen and paper out there. Let's start writing down some more numbers. The numbers that we're getting here from the Journal of the American Medical Association, they say 280,000 people a year are being injured. Remember, the IOM said that it was 98,000. The research group that just did the Medicare, 37 million Medicare recipients, they looked at 7 million records over a period of about 10 years. They discovered that 195,000 a year were being killed just by the Medicare doctors. Just that one group alone. I mentioned before that we probably have some overlapping going on here. Some of those Medicare people are probably dying, and some of those IOM statistics are taking those into account. We don't know what the overlapping is. We've got 783,000. That was an estimate after we looked at eight research groups that looked at eight specifics. And then they put those specifics together, and they said, well, if 106,000 are dying from wrong medicine, and was another 80,000 or something like that are dying from bed sores and so on, you could have people that had both bad medicine and bed sores, which would be counting them twice. Well, now, we don't want to count people twice. I mean, you died in the hospital, you died from iatrogenic disease, but, you know, can we pinpoint the cause? I mean, each one that dies from iatrogenic disease we want to know about. If you had bed sores and you had bad medicine, the two of them together, then we would only want to count you in each category as one half a person. We wouldn't want to count you twice. Now, the underreporting of iatrogenic events, remember that? As few as 5% and no more than 20% of these iatrogenic acts are ever reported. So the reports that we're getting aren't from some news service or the CDC or the FDA. What they are, it's a report that is made from the analysis of the medical records. And nobody analyzes all of the medical records of all of the people in the country. They simply take a sample from a group of people and then extrapolate that for the entire nation. But if we take those numbers and we extrapolate them out, we come up with 98,000. Okay, let's take the number 98,000. I'll just round it off to 100, shall we? 100,000. Now, if it's true that the underreporting is as high as only 5% or as low as 20%, I know that's backwards. You know, it sounds backwards, but what we're trying to figure out here is how much is the underreporting going to deliver to us if we extrapolate that forward? And the answer is if 20% is being reported, then only 1 in 5 is being reported. So if we took 100,000, and that's the IOM report, and we took that extrapolation of, well, they only reported, you know, 1 out of 5 and came up with 100,000. If we reported all of them, we would come up with 500,000, wouldn't we? So now we've got 250,000, 280,000, we've got 500,000, 783,000, and we've got a couple other numbers as we progress along that are going to hit 800,000 and then 999,000. And if you take a look here, the numbers, as you progress along, tend to be getting higher and higher, not lower and lower. The numbers seem to be indicating with the underreporting and with the various groups that, in fact, there is some overestimation, but the overestimation isn't near as bad as we thought it was going to be. So it's probably not a million, but it's a hell of a lot more than 100,000. By at least another four times that, which is going to take us up to 500,000. So already my gut reaction is that we don't have a We don't have less than 500,000, that's a half a million a year, being killed by the doctors in the various groups because they're not reporting on themselves. And the way it's getting reported is through the autopsies. You know, the autopsy doesn't lie. When the autopsy doctor takes a blood sample and they send it over to the lab and they say, okay, well, what killed this guy? And they say, well, he's got five times the amount that it takes to kill you when you die from Vioxx poisoning or whatever the toxic substance is. Oh, well, then he died from Vioxx, or he died from this medication. He died from the bed sores. What killed this guy? Well, the bed sores created an infection, and he died from the infection. So he died from pneumonia, but the pneumonia was caused by the bed sores. Could that have been prevented? I don't know if bed sores can be prevented or not. I presume that they can. According to the reports here, they say it's an iatrogenic disease. Well, how about the infections that you get in the hospital? You know, they've got a thing called staph infection. You go to the hospital, I don't know how many it affects, but it's a bunch. I mean, you went into the hospital to have gallbladder surgery and you come up with an infection that damn near killed you, or in many cases does kill you. Well, what about those? Are those preventable? You know, lay people would say, well, no, but according to these experts, well, yeah, those are preventable. Remember, last time I told you about the janitor that comes in. Is he washing his hands? No, he's just a hospital worker. The scrub woman comes in. She's a Mexican wetback that swam across the Rio Grande River, got a job in the hospital because to her, it pays $1 million a year, and to the hospital, it's slave labor. Is she washing her hands, and is she practicing the kind of hygiene that needs to be practiced in a hospital to keep from spreading infectious diseases like staph infection from one room to the next or one patient to the next? See, those are the kind of problems that create this thing called iatrogenic disease. And when you go to the hospital, you're not going to influence the hospital. You're not going to fire all the Mexican maids and all of the janitors because you're in the hospital for a day or a week. So I told you here about the John Deere company. So you got the problem here with the pharmaceutical company hiring, paying for, bribing, stealing the results that they want to get the drug approved. Then once the drug is approved, we all become the guinea pigs taking the drug for a period of 5 years, like Vioxx, to find out, well, how does it affect us? After 5 years, we say, oh my God, it's killing 100,000 people a year. Pull it from the market. Now, of course, that turns into a lot of lawsuits. And that's why they don't report this, because it turns into lawsuits. Pharmaceutical companies don't want these numbers reported. Doctors don't want them reported. Hospitals don't want them reported. It's bad for business. I am giving you a report that is bad for the medical business. You know, if just one of you people out there listening to this program goes to some of these sources and says, oh my God, I think I'll stay away from doctors and hospitals, I have damaged the medical industry. Well, what if ABC and CBS and Dan Rather and 60 Minutes and all these guys got on this story and said, hey, let's tell you what's really going on. Don't worry about the 2,000 that are being killed over in Iraq. You need to be concerned about the 3,000 that are being killed every day by doctors and hospitals and nurses in this country. Now, the number of 3,000 a day, remember, 3,000 times 365 would take us up to 1 million people a year. Now that's about our top number. Remember, we had one number here, it was 1,100,000+. There's another number coming up here that's going to take us down to about 1 million. We've already seen numbers that ranged up to 783,000. We've seen numbers as low as 98,000, but if we extrapolate that number forward based upon the reporting that is coming in, and they take a look at the reports, and the autopsy guys, and they say, well, here's what the guy actually died of, but here was the report of what he died of. That's why I reported to you earlier. When a guy dies, AIDS was the underlying cause of his death, but he actually died from pneumonia. So the birth certificate or the death certificate says, hey, he died of pneumonia. So AIDS deaths in this country are woefully underreported. In fact, I will bet you that in Africa, you're getting a truer picture of people dying from AIDS and the number of people dying from AIDS and infected than you're getting in the United States. Because they're telling us here in this country, it's gone down because they're given a medicine. The medicine doesn't cure this guy of AIDS. It treats the disease for an extra 5 years or so, and he dies, all right. But he dies 5 or 10 years from now. He would have died in a year or two, but he takes 5 to 10 years to die. He dies anyway. And he isn't reported as an AIDS sufferer because he had AIDS and he was taking these AIDS medications. They call it a cocktail of medications. He died from something else. Drug overdose or liver failure or kidney failure or. Guy's got AIDS and he's taking this drug cocktail and he dies of what? Liver failure? Kidney failure? Come on, guys, I'm just a crummy plumber, but that's AIDS that killed him. Now, what organ gave out first is not indicative of he died of liver failure. His liver failed because he had AIDS and it weakened his immune system to such a degree that his liver couldn't function anymore. The AIDS killed him. But we mislabeled these deaths. Very common practice. So in 1995, remember the JAMA report noted that over 1 million patients are injured in U.S. hospitals every year. 280,000 die annually as a result of these injuries. Therefore, the iatrogenic death rate dwarfs the annual automobile accident mortality rate of 45,000. Now, we get real excited in this country about traffic accidents and auto mortality. Let's just divide it out. 280,000. Divide that by 45,000. We have 6 times more people dying of iatrogenic disease than we have in automobile accidents. At a 1997 press conference, LEPI released a nationwide poll on patient iatrogenesis conducted by the National Patient Safety Foundation, which is sponsored by the American Medical Association. All right, now hold it right there. Hold it. Remember I said that you've got these institutions. Now you've got a group here that's called the National Patient Safety Foundation. And who created that organization or that entity? Well, the American Medical Association. So, you're not going to get any true, accurate, and correct, unbiased information out of this National Patient Safety Foundation. I had a little chit-chat the other day with my daughter. We were talking about automobiles, and she said, well, the Dodge over here, I forgot what the name of this testing organization is, but the Dodge came out number one. I said, of course. The testing organization was created by the Dodge Corporation. The Chrysler Corporation goes out and sets up a corporation for testing automobiles. And they go out and test automobiles. And when they pass in their report, the Dodge comes out number one. Chevrolet does the same thing. General Motors, Ford. You ever notice that they all say that our product is number one and we had this done at this testing organization? What would you think if I said the Gordon Law School is the number one law school of the United States as established by the Johnson Law School Testing Company? The Johnson Law School Testing Company. And the Gordon Law School is number one in the nation. Now, of course, what I need to do is to go out and create a testing company that goes out and tests law schools. And don't you think that my law school testing company is going to rate my law school as being number one and the Harvard Law School as being number 7 or 9? You know, You can't depend upon any of these analyses. And here's this one here, the National Patient Safety Foundation, called the NPSF, which is sponsored by the American Medical Association. Well, Leapy is a founding member of the NPSF, and the survey found that more than 100 million Americans have been affected directly or indirectly by a medical mistake. 42% were affected directly, and 84% personally knew of somebody who had experienced a medical mistake. Well, I guess I'm kind of an oddball. I'm 67 years old, and I don't know of a single person that I can remember that's ever suffered from a medical mistake. I've been in the hospital two or three times. I had pneumonia when I was a kid. In fact, I had pneumonia. I've been in the hospital twice with pneumonia and once with an accident. And I don't know of any medical mistakes that were made on me. And I know of a lot of people that have been to the hospitals, and you know, I don't know of a single person that has had a medical mistake that I know of personally. Not a single one. That doesn't mean that some medical mistakes didn't occur to my granny when she was in the hospital, but to my knowledge, it never affected her adversely. My Aunt Bessie was a nurse. She used to be in the hospital, and she didn't have any adverse reactions. Now, I will say this. My wife, my first wife, worked at the Veterans Hospital, and she said that it looked like to her that the patients were getting poor treatment, and that it would, if she didn't know better, appear that the Veterans Hospital had a policy of killing the veterans who were in there. Well, I knew of a guy by the name of Jess Sears. He used to be my company painter, and he was an Ogla Indian. And I mean, he was a healthy dude. He was an alcoholic, but I mean, he was healthy. And old Jess would go out to lunch, and he'd come back from lunch drunk. And he'd get up on that scaffold and just scared the hell out of me. I thought he'd going to fall off that scaffold up there. But, you know, he'd kind of wobble around up on that scaffold. And he was a painter. I mean, he was a good painter. Hell of a painter. Now, he was a veteran from World War II. And old Jess, one day, he said, you know, I ain't feeling too good. And I said, what's the matter, Jess? And he says, I don't know. But he said, I think I'll go find out. I'm a veteran. I'm going up to the Veterans Hospital and have them give me some tests and see if I'm all right. And so he went up to the Veterans Hospital, and they run a bunch of tests on him, and they came back and they said, oh, no, Jess, you're not all right. You need a lot of medical help. So Jess came back to me, and he said, no, I'm not feeling very good. And he said, because I'm sick, I can get as much on Social Security, and I don't need to work, because I can get more, or just about as much, not working as I can working. And I said, well, gee, Jess, I guess I can't blame you for that. So old Jess quit working for me, and he went on disability. And with his disability and with his ailments, he went to the Veterans Hospital, and they were treating him, I guess. I don't know what they did to him, but within 2 years, Jess was dead. Within 2 years, he was a goner. And my wife happened to be working up there at the Veterans Hospital at the time, and I remember her saying to me that she thought that the Veterans Hospital had a policy of killing their patients. Well, that would make all the sense in the world. You see, if you're a veteran, and let's say you're a Gulf War veteran, and you come back and you've got this Gulf War veteran syndrome, and we're going to have to treat you in the Veterans Hospital system for the next 30, 40 years. That could cost us a lot of money. But if you just died, you know, that would solve our problem. You know, we'd just spend the burial benefit on you, and we could get out from under this 30, 40 years of hospitalization. And did you notice, you Gulf War vets, the government to this day says, oh, no, it isn't anything that we did. I mean, you get tens of thousands of veterans over here complaining of the same maladies. Is it the spent uranium in the shells? Is it the gas over there? I don't know. Is it the aspartame in the soft drinks you were drinking? I don't know what your problems are, per se. I just know what what I read in the papers, as old Will Rogers said. And I'm just reporting to you about one guy that I knew named Jess Sears. I don't have any reason to believe that the Veterans Hospital killed Jess. I don't have any evidence that Jess was maltreated, mistreated, or the subject of iatrogenic disease. I don't know that. But based upon the numbers, I'll bet you if somebody were to take Jess Sears' medical records and analyze them, they'd probably come up to a conclusion, though. I wonder what would happen if somebody got into the veterans system and started analyzing the deaths of all the veterans. I don't know of a single veteran. I want to say this. I don't know of a single veteran that I've had personal contact with that died over age 70. I've known a lot of veterans from World War II, but I don't know of any that have lived to be 70 years old yet. Personally, I've read about them and heard about them, you know. So that tells me something. That says to me that when you get into the veteran system and you start taking that medical care from the veteran system, that you don't fare out near as well. You don't live as long. Now, I've known of a few people that are World War II veterans and so on that have stayed out of the medical system. They're iconoclasts. I mean, they're health food nuts. Now, those guys, they seem to be making it all right. I know of quite a few guys that are 70, 80 years old. They're old-timey veterans that have not participated in the veterans medical system, and they've lived over 70 years. But by God, anybody that I know of that's got into the veterans system or been getting that freebie medical care. Here's a little something for you. In 1962 or 3, the doctors in Israel, they have socialized medicine. The doctors went on strike for about 3 months. The death rate went down 25%. Death rate went down 25%. I've got a report here that says the more doctors there are in an area, the higher the incidence of iatrogenic disease. And one of the reports here points out that in places like the Northwest Territories in Canada, in Alaska, where among the Indian and Eskimo tribes, where they have less and less medical care, they have less and less iatrogenic disease. But when you get to Philadelphia, Chicago, and New York, where you've got lots of doctors, you get more iatrogenic disease. So the report says, do doctors cause iatrogenic disease? And the answer is, yes, they do. And the more contact that you as a layperson has with a doctor or a healthcare provider, the greater your risk of iatrogenic disease. Now that kind of tells you a little bit of a story there. That'll be almost like saying, well, the closer the contact that you have with a plumber, the more likely you are to die of cancer. Well, you know, if I got those correlations together, I would avoid plumbers like AIDS, herpes, and VD. And that's why I avoid hospitals and healthcare providers and doctors, because the incidence of doctor death, death by medicine, there is a correlation between the two. And that's what these reports show. And I probably have 15, 20 reports here. I won't be able to read them all to you, but I can read you the highlights off of them. And I can tell you where to go to get them. And this one here is called www.lef.org. It's a 29-page report. I've hit some of the key highlights. I'll have to leave it right there because I'm out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. Let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, I'm out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.